Norm Shealy. Norm Shealy. You are listening to Infinite Consciousness, your infinite access to the world
of the mind.
Welcome to Infinite Consciousness tonight, and thanks for listening. This is Eva Herr, and tonight I have with us Stephanie Marone, and we're going to talk about her book, The Natural Medicine Guide to Bipolar Disorder. How are you, Stephanie?
Well, I'm pretty good, recovering from a cold, actually, so if I sound a little funny, that's why. Hi, Eva. How are you?
I'm fine, but you can't tell you have a cold. This is a great book, by the way.
Oh, good.
A really good book. I really like this book.
Thank you.
Before we get started, take a couple minutes and tell us a little bit about you and where we can find you and maybe any other books that you have out.
Great, thanks. Yes, I'm a writer first and came to writing about so-called mental disorders second, but I do have sort of a background that led me to it in a number of ways. I think it's easy to say that depression runs in my family, so that's one thing. Not debilitating, not clinical necessarily, but it's definitely a trend. And then I got my degree in dance therapy, my college degree, and that brought me into contact with institutions and the way that they deal with mental illness. They would let the dance therapists loose on the lockup ward because they figured we couldn't do any harm. So I got to see from the inside what was going on there, and it was pretty shocking. That was in the 70s, and, you know, not the ancient snake pit times, but it still was pretty shocking. So I was fascinated with so-called mental disorders because of that experience and my dance therapy training, which one of the things that the dance therapy had success with back then was autism. So in my series of books, there's six of them on each of the Natural Medicine Guide 2, and then it's each a mental disorder. So the bipolar disorder is what we're talking about tonight. There's also one on autism and schizophrenia and anxiety and addiction and depression. And what was interesting about this series for me was I really expected autism to do quite well, unfortunately, because so many people need the information because autism has become such an epidemic. I was taken by surprise by how many people wanted the information in the bipolar book. It has sold as many, and I think actually surpassed the autism book at this point. And I was taken aback by that. The numbers of people who have bipolar, it's increasing all the time. So people are really in need of some kind of natural medicine approach because the lithium route, while it saved lives, is not a satisfactory approach for a lot of people. So that was where I came to writing these books. And I've also done a couple of anthologies, one on audacious aging. That was another subject close to my heart, since we're all aging. And then an anthology called Goddess Shift, Women Leading for a Change, which is another very close to my heart subject as I watch the culture, as I watch women take an equal place at the table of our culture. It's been very exciting watching this shift in our society. I have a new book coming out in February. Actually, there's a new edition of the bipolar book coming out in February, but also I have another one. It's called What the Animals Taught Me, Stories of Love and Healing from a Farm Animal Sanctuary, because I have a small farm animal sanctuary. And I'm doing...
You have another one, too, don't you, about first aid, natural first aid?
Yes, I do. Thank you. That was the first one I did. It's Natural Medicine First Aid Remedies, and I did that to have all the different therapies in one place for each of the kind of household conditions that many of us are afflicted with at one time or another in our lives. And I was tired of looking in all these different books to find the natural solution for something, and so I put eight therapies under each condition that people can have a choice of what they might want to use, from homeopathy to herbal remedies to supplements to food choices that can help.
I've got that book. It's a good book as well. I found
thank
a useful
you.
Book.
Thank you.
And where can people find you?
Yes, thanks. It's I'm in Northern California, north of San Francisco, and my website is www.stephaniemarone.com. It's STEPHANIEMAROHN.com.
Okay. So let's go. And I have to say this. I have a bipolar friend in my life, several of them. And I have been shocked. Actually, once you sit and analyze some of your friends, you realize that a lot of them at least have probably minor bipolar issues and don't even know it.
Mm.
So I think that's a good book for anybody to read if you have any kind of mood disorder, because it's very helpful in helping you identify that thing. So what is bipolar disorder, Stephanie?
Well, it is a psychiatric label. From the American Psychiatric Association, and we don't need to go into a discussion of the labels and how helpful or not helpful they are, but it's characterized by, I mean, traditionally the picture of bipolar disorder is that it's characterized by mood swings from depression on one end to a mania, as it was used to be called, manic depressive disorder, so-called mania on the other end, which is a kind of hyperactivity and out of control, high movement in terms of the mind races. But most people do not fit into that classic division of the moods. There's something called hypomania, which is a mild form of mania. And in actuality, many creative people, when they're creating, are in a hypomanic kind of state. So it's this range of mood disorders, and some people that qualify as having bipolar disorder are unipolar, actually. They only experience one end. So it's really kind of a large umbrella for the mood disorders.
I'd like for you to, because my particular friend went to the doctor for years and said that he was depressed. So the doctor gave him antidepressants. And only when he met me did he realize that he could have some other label attached. You know, so I mean, you got to have some way to talk about it. Even though I don't agree with you, no labels.
That's why I say so-called mental disorders, because we do have to be able to talk about it, and it is helpful to have it described in some way, and that the label is a shorthand way to describe it.
Yeah. So I want you, if you would, talk about the symptoms, because I've seen him, my friend, go from saying, "Let's stay up all night, Eva," to the next day he was in the bed for 3 weeks.
Yeah, the depression associated with this disorder can be...
And rage. I want you to talk about that,
and,
too.
And rage.
Rage and paranoidism and all the things, you know, that cover those things, so people can get an understanding of, hey, maybe this is something that I might look into for myself.
Yeah, well, there's such a range of symptoms, and it, you know, we're talking about an individual, so we don't know, like rage, for example, what is that about? Is that part of the disorder, or is that from something else in the individual? So I think it really, while it's helpful to have this umbrella label, I think it doesn't necessarily serve the individual to say, oh, all of this is because of my bipolar disorder.
Sure.
I think that, you know, every individual needs to approach what's going on with them individually. And so it's really about, in my mind, it's really about finding the underlying imbalances, whether that's on a physical, a mental, or a spiritual level. That said, some of the characteristic symptoms that induce a psychiatrist to give this label to people are inflated self-esteem or grandiosity. This is associated with the manic kind of state. Reduced need for sleep, increased or more continued talking than usual, flight of ideas, racing thoughts, distractibility, increased activity and energy or agitation, excessive engagement in high-consequence activities. These are the shopping binges where people spend tens of thousands of dollars and run up credit cards. So, you know, all of those things other people could be doing these, and it's not bipolar. So that said, the other end, the major depressive episode, is characterized by persistent sadness, significantly reduced interest or pleasure, change in weight or appetite, insomnia or oversleeping, and here we have restlessness, agitation, or lethargy. So again, there can be, in a depression, there can be a kind of pull within the depression, fatigue or lack of energy, feelings of worthlessness or excessive or inappropriate guilt, problems thinking, concentrating, or making decisions, recurrent thoughts of death or suicide. And again, all of these things could characterize something else. But in general, that's the rough picture of what is called bipolar disorder 1, and then there's various variations on the theme. In terms of the rage, I don't really know how to speak to that, Eva, because...
Well, I've seen it. It's things like acting inappropriately. You're fine 1 minute, and then just all of a sudden, out of the blue, somebody says a word, or somebody pulls out in front of you in a car, and the person may suffer instantaneous road rage. You know, it's something that it's not, you know, relationship kind of rages from something that happened necessarily, but a rage at an inappropriate time in an inappropriate manner that's well out of proportion for what's going on.
Yeah, I see what you're
saying.
And it
like comes out of nowhere.
And
that
would be part of we know very clearly that behavior relates to our biochemistry. So if the biochemistry is out of whack, our behavior can go off in all different directions. And that's something that didn't used to be recognized, you know, the idea that was the biochemistry would only have a physical effect. But it's very clear that biochemistry produces behavioral effects.
Another thing I found very, very interesting to observe in this person is paranoia. And it's probably not as bad as some people, but I wanted to make people aware. Constant worry that some governmental agency is watching. Constant issues having to have your total privacy. Constant issues and not wanting anybody to know where you live or wanting your phone number. For what reason? You know,
well, that has characteristics of what is called schizoaffective disorder.
Mm-hmm.
So it's kind of a combination. It's got the paranoia of the psychosis of schizophrenia, that and delusions perhaps, paranoia and delusions, and that's the reason why it's called schizoaffective disorder, is because this form of disorder has a combination of the mood disorder and the schizophrenic delusion paranoia issues.
Okay. After we get through going through these things right here, I'm going to ask you things about different supplements to address different kinds of stuff. So be knowing that that's coming.
Okay.
I'm not going to ignore that. I just want to ask some questions first about these, so people will have an idea of what they are.
Mm-hmm.
So people who are bipolar, do they have a higher risk of suicide?
Yes. Anybody with a so-called mental disorder has a higher risk. That's been shown by research, all many studies. Yeah, it's very clear, the link.
And I'm going to ask another question about that in a second, but I skipped one here. Well, you talked about bipolar disorder type 1. What is bipolar disorder type 2?
You know...
What's the difference?
Yeah. I'm hesitating because I like to spend a lot of time on the categories of diagnosis, because I think the underlying disturbances are so similar for all of them that I think it would behoove the listeners to have information on that rather than on the particular disorders themselves.
Okay.
But I can just say briefly that it's more common than bipolar disorder 1, and it's a more common among women, and the depressive end is more operational in bipolar disorder 2, but anyone who wants to know the details of these characteristics, all they have to do is go online and look in the DSM-IV. It's the Diagnostic and Statistical Manual that the American Psychiatric Association uses for diagnosis. It's the Bible that has all the characteristics and what is required in order to be given that diagnosis. They have to have two of these and one of these, so it's pretty complex.
Okay. Can you discuss rapid cycling? Is that something that interests me in watching my friend?
Well, this is a devastating condition to have because
it is, really.
There's no break. The cycles of mood changes come so quickly that the person is not sitting in depression or living in mania. They're going back and forth and all over the place very, very quickly. So, and it can be, for some people, in a matter of minutes. So it can hardly even be called episodes, whereas, you know, they can say a depressive episode, which lasts for weeks, or a manic episode, which lasts for weeks. This is happening so quickly that you can hardly even call it an episode. And it's really one of the criteria for a diagnosis of a mental disorder is the how much it interferes with the person's functioning in life, and rapid cycling would really interfere.
It's been a horrible experience for my friend.
I'm so
really
sorry that
because of his the doctor's
friend has this.
Yeah, the doctors just say, oh, you're depressed. You know, they don't. Anyway,
this is a good moment for me to say that one of the issues with that is that antidepressants can actually worsen the bipolar circumstances for people. So if someone has bipolar and they're diagnosed with depression and given an antidepressant, that might actually worsen their cycling and worsen their condition. So that is a reason right there to get a correct diagnosis.
And I think
because if they dismiss it as depression, they can actually worsen your condition.
I think it's important that people, you know, many people think that it has a stigma attached, bipolar. And so they don't tell their doctor all of the symptoms that they have. They just tell them about, or they're afraid they're going to get in trouble or whatever. So they just say, I'm depressed and I stay in the bed. They don't say all of the things that are going on. And I think it's very important for them to understand how important it is that they be very clear with their physician about what is going on and not just one of the symptoms, but tell them, because that's what I found with this, my friend.
Well, I think another important thing to add there, though, is that it's really important to have a practitioner you can trust.
So, absolutely.
You know, if you have a trusting relationship with your physician, it is absolutely the best thing to be completely honest and put it all out there, but you need to be careful because there are people, there are physicians out there who don't necessarily have the whole picture of mental illnesses and so may not be responding in an appropriate way.
So I want to go back to the suicide thing because there is a high statistic of suicide among bipolar people. So could you tell us some symptoms or some signs to watch for?
Yes, let me get to that section because I don't have them memorized. Yeah, so these are the signs put out by, I believe this is, I'm not sure if this is the American Psychiatric Association, but these are the generally recognized signs. Feelings of hopelessness, worthlessness, anguish or depression, and or desperation. And I should add at this point that these signs are for people who, you know, if you observe these in any of your friends or family, these are warning signs to you. The person who is having these feelings themselves is not necessarily the best person because if you're deep into these symptoms yourself, you're not going to be you're not going to be seeing them necessarily as something that you need to get alarmed about. So this is really for, look at your loved ones and friends if they have many of these, and it's up to you to do something to get some intervention of some kind. So feelings of hopelessness, worthlessness, anguish or desperation, withdrawal from people and activities, that's a big one, preoccupation with death or morbid subjects, you might not always see that one, sudden mood improvement or increased activity after a period of depression. And this is one that people often take this as an improvement. You know, they say, oh, the person is doing so much better. This is kind of a red flag that it may be getting close. And that's
what do you mean? Describe that better, please.
Sudden mood improvement or increased activity after a period of depression. This is a tricky one because it actually may be a mood improvement that's going to last, but it also could be like this spike of improvement or activity that a person can demonstrate this when they've made the decision to do the suicide.
Oh, so they've kind of made the decision, I'm going to do this, so they're happy because they finally have an answer to their solution.
Yes, it's released something. So If it doesn't, you know, that's kind of a tricky one because, you don't want your friends to see you watching really closely and you know, being like big brother. But on the other hand, if someone has this, you do need to watch them closely. So that one's kind of a hard one to figure out sometimes because you can't tell if it's real or not, meaning if they're really coming out,
right.
If they really come out of their depression. Increase in risk-taking behaviors is another sign. Of course, buying a gun and putting affairs in order, that's another big red flag. And also what they call suicidal ideation, which is thinking, talking, or writing about a plan for committing suicide. And so if you observe these signs in someone that you love, you really ought to consult your doctor and see if you can get some help.
Okay. So
or perhaps, depending on what's going on, you know, perhaps the first thing is to talk to the person. But you have to, I think it's something that you need to come up with the people around this person, the loved ones, the family, figured out together what needs to be done.
So let's talk now about some of the factors. And the factors that I kind of want to talk about is the ones that we can really do something about, like hypoglycemia.
Yes.
Neurotransmitter imbalances, nutrition, things like allergies. Talk about those, the things that people can actually do something about in their life. What things would someone look at in their life that they could actually change that might have an effect?
Big thing. Get enough sleep. Don't live on coffee and Coke. Meaning Coca-Cola with lots of caffeine in it. Well, also cocaine, not a good idea. Any recreational drugs can exacerbate the whole condition. So, tobacco, caffeine, recreational drugs, all those things can actually exacerbate it. So the formula is get enough sleep, keep the stress level down. In order to deal with stress response, people often do things that make it worse, and eat nutritious food. Those are and avoid recreational drugs and caffeine as much as possible. Also, don't live on sugar. These are all things that can make it worse. So those are kind of basic things that that people can do in their lives. I want to say about this book that bipolar disorder is a serious condition, so this is not the therapies that I cover in this book are not really self-help therapies. For example, there are supplements that are. It's been shown that these supplements tend to be deficient in nutritional supplements tend to be vitamins and minerals that tend to be deficient in people with bipolar. But it's not a good idea just to throw nutritional supplements at it. Because everyone is different, and so the approach to dealing with these factors that are going on for the individual is not as much a self-help approach. There are things that I just mentioned you can do, but it's really a good idea to get biochemical testing, as one example, to see what nutritional deficiencies and how severe are going on. And then the nutritional supplements can be compounded.
Excuse me.
Can be compounded to meet that individual's precise needs. For one thing, the amounts have to be pretty high. So what a lot of people do is take some of the supplements that are known to be a problem, that are known to tend to be deficient in people with bipolar, but they don't take enough. And you have to also have to look at quality. A lot of the vitamins and minerals being sold are not high enough quality. So
sure.
it's really a much more complex approach than let's come up with the various supplements and take them.
Well, you did bring up in your book hypoglycemia, and that in my personal observation, one of the things that I've seen is about every 3.5 hours, I can see indications that if something doesn't happen, there will be an episode. And we've learned to say, you need some food.
Yes, that's excellent.
You know, and if when we do the food, when we do the food thing consistently, and it's, you know, it's some protein thing, obviously, if you have
mm-hmm.
hypoglycemia, we don't get the episode. It kind of backs off and kind of goes away. And I've also seen, you know, that little indention underneath your nose? I don't
yes.
know what you call that thing.
Like
I found
cleft,
this very interesting. Huh?
The cleft?
Whatever that little indention is, underneath your nose but above your lip in the middle.
Yeah.
That thing, whatever that is.
Mm-hmm.
Whenever an episode is going to come, 2 or 3 days before it happens, before a mania episode happens, not the depression, but the mania,
mm-hmm.
that thing flattens out. Now, I don't know if anybody else has ever noticed that, but I learned to pay attention to it. So I watch that thing, and when that thing flattens out, I know that something's coming within 2 or 3 days. So we really have to watch that blood sugar level in those 2 or 3 days.
Oh, that
Isn't
is really...
Isn't that an interesting thing?
That is really so wonderful that you
and
discovered
it's
these
no
things.
No fail. It is every single time. So I don't know what the deal is with that thing.
Very interesting. I've never heard that before, but I hope somebody... I hope people that are out there that hear this write to you to let you know.
So let's talk about lithium first.
Let's
of
just
all.
Say about first. Let's just say about hypoglycemia, low blood sugar. So again, that's dietary. So this is a part of don't get hungry, don't get sleepy. You know, try to keep yourself well supplied with nutrition. And if you're someone that needs to graze rather than eat 3 separate meals, then that's the thing to do. Because
oh, that's a good idea.
Yeah. But
never heard it put that way, but that's a great idea.
Yeah, it really needs to be the individual has to figure out what works and what foods help at those moments, and protein is what you're saying. Certainly you don't want to have donuts.
Sure. Now, yeah. I changed my mind. I don't want to go to lithium. I want to go back to the neurotransmitter testing. Where do you recommend somebody, how do you recommend somebody get their neurotransmitter levels tested?
Well, first I want to say that in this book I give 20 factors that play a role in bipolar disorder, and I want to say that it is rare for a person to have one cause. So it's sort of like the straw that broke the camel's back. Like, there is no proof of a genetic component in any mental disorders, but some of them tend to run in families. What does that mean? It means perhaps that there's a weakness in the neurological system, for example, that given the right amount, combination of environmental triggers, the disorder will develop. So, for example, by environmental triggers, I mean things like diet, sleeping patterns, toxins, toxic exposure, hypoglycemia, you know, any combination, allergies, any combination of these factors that I talk about. But just so that people know, most of these disorders are complex, and actually most chronic health conditions are complex, so it's rarely one cause. So it's important to look at all of these factors. That said, the neurotransmitter deficiency or imbalance or dysfunction, the way that they do a test, they can't test directly for that, but what they do is test for the building blocks, which is the amino acids. So, for example, there's William Walsh, who in PhD in Warrenville, Illinois, who is at the Pfeiffer Research Institute this is the he's the heir apparent of Abram Hoffer, who is the one who founded.
Who is it?
Abram Hoffer.
I know Abram. He was a friend of mine.
Right. So
what about
William Walsh? Worked with Carl Pfeiffer, who worked with Abram Hoffer. So the Carl Pfeiffer Center. Let me get the name right because I haven't looked at it in a little while. It's got there's a research institute and there's a treatment center, both in one. And it's the Health Research Institute and the Pfeiffer Treatment Center. That's all one together. So it's called HRI/PTC.org is where you can find them. Anyway,
wait, say that again. I want to write it down.
Yeah,
HRI.
Health Research Institute.
Uh-huh.
And Pfeiffer Treatment Center. The acronym is HRI/PTC.
Okay. .org. Okay.
Yeah, and they're a wonderful place because they do biochemical testing, and what they also do, the research institute is where they do all the research on. They have a huge database, for example, on the biochemical test results of hundreds and hundreds of children with autism, for example. But they keep all their results, and they're doing research on what are the most common problems, and they much more complex research. I won't go into it. But the Pfeiffer Treatment Center is the treatment wing, and they have a compounding pharmacy that will come up with the exact combination of what an individual needs based on the biochemical testing, which would be blood, I think they do blood, saliva, hair, maybe they do urine testing, and they can see exactly what the deficiencies are. So if you have a deficiency in a certain amino acid, you're going to have a deficiency in the neurotransmitter that's the building blocks for.
Mm-hmm.
So for example, it's funny because GABA, which is is what they use for anti-anxiety. GABA is both the amino acid and the neurotransmitter, but that's the only one that I know of. And what they do in the compounding pharmacy, because one of the problems is compliance on taking many, many pills. So if you were going to take all the things you needed to take in order to correct your biochemical deficiencies or imbalances, you would have a lot of pills. So that's the advantage of the compounding pharmacy, is that they put it into a small number. They combine it all. So
do you have to go there?
You have to go there once and get the testing, and they meet with you. That's the advantage of, you don't have to go there for every visit. I mean, what I mean is you don't have to visit. What they do is they set you up after your first visit, and they may want you to come back, say, 6 months. For some people, it's a year to be retested. But they also hook you up with a practitioner in your area who can oversee the treatment that they are recommending. So they'll put you on a supplement protocol, for example, and you'll have someone in your area. And they don't have all areas covered, but they have quite a few, where you can work with that person to make sure that you're doing it correctly, or to check with them if you have any questions.
Well, that's good to know.
Yes, it's a really helpful service. And there's another one that's kind of similar. It's called ReardonClinic.org. It's in Wichita, Kansas. That's R-I-O-R-D-A-N Clinic.org. And they have a similar biochemical approach.
Are these nonprofits?
Certainly the Research Institute is nonprofit. I'm not sure how they arrange it with the two entities. Probably the whole thing is nonprofit because so much of it is research.
Interesting.
But I'm not sure how they deal with the clinic part.
Okay. So what else do we need to look at? Heavy metals. Does someone get tested for that?
That's hair analysis for the most part. And that is the heavy metals that are most implicated are mercury, from those old fillings that were called silver fillings, but they're half mercury, and they leach the whole time they're in your mouth. And I, for example, had all mine replaced, which isn't a fun process, but and it has to be replaced by a dentist who knows what he or she is doing, because taking them out can actually release more mercury vapor in your body if it's not done correctly than leaving them in.
So how do you know who to go see?
You need to talk to the dentist and say, are you acquainted with, have you done mercury amalgam removal, and what precautions do you take to keep the vapors and the pieces of mercury from going back into my body? So, for example, when they're taking it out, if they're not doing suction all the time, you might swallow some of that. So, they put on, like the dentist that I went to, the people wore hoods to protect themselves from the vapors, and they had a machine that looks kind of like a vacuum hose that was just sucking the vapor the whole time. So it really needs to be someone that knows what they're doing.
Okay.
Plus, they used a rubber guard to prevent the mercury from going anywhere.
Okay. Are there any specific symptoms that are related with the heavy metal poisonings and bipolar? I don't know if there is or not. Just crossed my mind to ask that.
Yeah. Well, one of the things that really happens when depression certainly is. That's one of the symptoms of mercury toxicity is depression. But then what I noticed when I had them removed was the removal of brain fog. I was
really
amazed. Yeah, I didn't even know how much I had. And it was dramatic.
That's
so
amazing.
You know, that's
I'm glad to know that.
Yeah. So there's a long list of things that go with mercury toxicity, and many of them are symptoms of bipolar, such as depression and anxiety. And it just, you know, lack of energy, nervousness, irritability, insomnia, lack of concentration.
How fast did you notice the improvement?
Well, I need to say that one of the things that I also did at the same time was I had, because we're walking around with all this mercury in our body already, you know, I had those fillings for 30 years.
Mm-hmm.
So I knew that I was tested, and I did have not high levels, but I'd say mild to moderate levels of mercury. And so I did a mercury chelation right around that same time.
How'd you do it? What kind of chelation did you use?
It was intravenous.
Like EDTA or something?
It's the other one. I'm not remembering what the substance
okay.
is. Like,
but it wasn't some oral supplement or something?
No, the intravenous is the most effective. And DMPS, I think it's called, the substance they use to get the... It's a chelation, for those who don't know. C-H-E-L-E, means claw. And so chelation, what happens is the substance, which I'm remembering right, was DMPS, it binds with the mercury like a claw, grabs hold of it, and then it's excreted from the body. So it was within less than a week of having both those procedures, and I had both those procedures at the same time.
Now, what kind, did you have any detox symptoms?
Because I had the chelation.
That's what I mean. Did the chelation cause any detox? Because my daughter's doing a heavy metal detox program, but she's doing it through compounded minerals, these special things that Pam Colleen's doing.
Right.
And, man, her detox symptoms have been tough.
Is she taking chlorella?
I don't know what she's taking. Pam's got her on about 8 different things, and it started out, but it's really changed her. I mean, she feels better. She said her brain fog's gone away, and she feels good about her life. But first of all, she went through this terrible nausea. Then she broke out in these thousands of itchy bumps. Did you have to do any of that with that?
No, I didn't. And I think that's because the intravenous chelation is so effective. Plus, they had told me to take chlorella a month before I went and a month after. So chlorella.
Really? What does that do?
It's a natural chelator.
I didn't know that.
Yeah, it supplements the heavy duty process. So you might find out if there's any chlorella in that substance in the substances she's taking. If there's not, add it in, because it's
interesting.
Yeah, it's, and cilantro is also a natural chelator. These
really?
Of course, these of course are not as strong as the so-called big guns, but they are natural chelators.
Did you just do the cilantro, the herb itself, or did you do?
I did chlorella. Chlorella. Okay. No, I took chlorella tablets. Was concentrated.
Interesting. Mm-hmm. Okay, what about food allergies? What symptoms would one have if they have food allergies?
Well, what's interesting about that is that, you know, people think of the classic symptoms, you know, okay, gastrointestinal stuff, right? But that is just the beginning of it. There, and a lot of people are not aware that there's actually what goes into your intestines can end up in your brain, which is a very strange concept, but it's true. It gets absorbed in the intestines into the bloodstream and then crosses the blood-brain barrier into the brain. And that doesn't mean that the bagel you eat ends up in your brain, but the things, you know, that are broken down from that bagel do. So in terms of food allergies, it was long not recognized. Again, the behavioral changes that can come with food allergies, those were the hidden secret. It's almost as though there is no symptom that can't be a function of food allergies. The symptoms are so wide-ranging. So we'll just take an example of an allergy to gluten, say. So that's the component of wheat, for example, where people can have almost like an addictive response to eating the gluten where they just want to eat it all the time, but yet it makes them glazed over and brain fogged, and they might behave in a hyperactive way. So it's really significant. And the way you can approach that is if after you eat something, and it's hard to separate it out, so one of the things people do is the so-called elimination diet, where you eat a limited number of foods, you cut something out and then see if something changes, and then you introduce that back in and see if something changes. So that's a kind of laborious way to go about it. A quicker way is the kinesiological muscle testing, which is some acupuncturists do this, some chiropractors, but applied kinesiologists do it as well. Some NAET, which is the Nambujirpad Allergy Elimination Techniques, any practitioner of NAET would do the muscle testing to see if someone is allergic to a certain substance. That's a pretty quick way to do it.
Okay, we have about 10 minutes left, and I have about 10 more questions, so I think I'll just let you talk about what you think is most important rather than me just picking out what I wanted to talk about.
Well,
if you want to do it that way.
There's so many things.
I can tell you. What I was kind of interested in is methylation, high histamine, important of folates, the B vitamins, amino acids, you know.
There is no show after you, so you can go as long as you'd like.
So those are the kinds of things that I was a little bit interested in.
Those are some of the research of William Walsh, Dr. William Walsh, who I was speaking of, and that's pretty complicated stuff. Doesn't mean that we can't understand it, but it's part of the. There's nothing that an individual can do about that without knowing they have those issues. So they need to get biochemically tested.
And where would you recommend they do that?
That would be the William Walsh Center, and there are many people that cannot go to Illinois to do that, or to Kansas to the Reardon Clinic, but it's tough because it really has to be someone who knows what they're doing in terms of this testing, and unfortunately, I can't recommend 10 places around the country that people can go to. These are the two that I know are completely reputable, know exactly what they're doing, and people can actually get results with the protocols based on that testing. So,
And
one of the things people can do is check with those two places and find out if there's anyone they recommend in their area.
Okay. Something that you talked about that was important in your book, some simple things that they can do at home is make sure they, you can talk about essential fatty acids and the B vitamins and the five levels of healing model. That should take up these last few minutes.
Yeah, the five levels of healing. Thank you for bringing that up, Eva. That is a truly inspired model by Dr. Dietrich Klinghardt, MD, PhD. He's a German doctor who has he's been a doctor for decades, and he now mostly teaches other doctors his techniques because he's truly an inspired physician and researcher as well. But his model of healing is that there are five levels that go from the physical, which is call it the bottom level, if you will, and then the spiritual is the top level. So it goes, see if I can remember this right, physical, electromagnetic. I'm going to have to consult it because I'm not remembering all the levels off the top of my head.
Here, I have it for you.
Okay, good. Would you say it, please?
The physical, which is the phospholipid spectrum disorder, electromagnetic, mental, that involves unresolved childhood issues, which I thought was very important.
That would be
very
mental, emotional, yeah.
And intuitive and spiritual.
Right. We're missing one, though.
That's all that.
Electromagnetic, yeah.
Yeah,
the
we
second is
said
the electromagnetic,
that.
Yeah. Yes, and what the way that these five levels work is that for true healing, you need to address any imbalances that exist at any level. And the way that this works is it's fascinating that if you have an imbalance at the spiritual level, which I want to say about that level, that no one but you and your relationship to the higher power universe, you know, the energetic field, whatever you want to call that, no one but you should be dealing in that realm. So if anybody tries to heal you on that level, like a guru, for example,
mm-hmm.
that is between you and the universe. So that is for you to do. That's the
I
work
totally
at that level.
I totally agree with that perspective.
Yeah, the work at that level has to be you. And if a doctor is trying to do something for you at that level, there's something wrong. So a doctor or anybody else.
I totally agree with that.
Oh, I'm glad.
And everybody wants to get healed, and they want somebody to go see somebody and push a button, and then they're all healed. It doesn't work like that.
Right. It really
you
doesn't.
You have to do it. You have to do the work.
He really does have the model, and actually I should say this, of all the natural medicine doctors that I interviewed for my books, they all have the view that the individual needs to take responsibility for his or her own health, and that you can get assistance from all these people. I mean, we all need information, but ultimately it comes down to you. What are you going to do? And on all these levels, it needs to be addressed. So you get tested on the biochemical level, but here is the way that this and there are ways to test on each of these levels except for the top one. That test is up to you. You know, how are you doing on that level? Does your life have meaning? Does your life have purpose? Are you feeling connected up spiritually in whatever that means to you? It doesn't have to be the word God. It can be a connection of love to the world at large, you know, whatever that sense of connection is for you. So one of the things that he talks about is that an imbalance on the bottom level, the physical level, it takes a long time for that to work its way up and affect each level above it. But if you have the imbalance, originating level, the imbalance is at the spiritual level, it cascades down to the physical really quickly. So let's leave spiritual out of it for a moment. Mental, emotional, we'll just say. So if you have a balance at the mental, emotional level, for example, childhood trauma, that can quickly produce physical symptoms. Whereas if you have, say, a vitamin B12 deficiency, it will take a long, and that's all you have, it will take a long time for that to produce changes on the other levels above it, produce emotional, mental changes, that kind of thing, unless it's a very severe deficiency. But if you fix, and also this is the beautiful part about his model, Dr. Klinghardt's model, is if you fix something, if you fix the problem at the spiritual level, the cascade of healing is very rapid as well. So the healing effects will quickly transfer down through the other levels. And so if you have a biochemical imbalance that you treat on the biochemical level, meaning you go to Dr. Walsh, you discover what your biochemical deficiencies and imbalances are, you have it corrected with compounds, the compounding supplements, you're religious about taking them, and there is no change, then it needs to be looked at. What's going on the other levels? Something is holding that in place.
Something that I thought interesting is, I think it was on the intuitive level, you said that when a person had issues as a child, where one, like they had a sibling maybe, where one sibling was treated differently.
Mm-hmm.
Do you remember that? You talked about that on the intuitive thing. Let me see if I can find it.
Sorry, I don't, but can you refresh my memory?
Well, you just said that people that had, on the intuitive level, people that had issues as a child, let's say where they had a parent that treated a sibling differently, so that you, really it's binary issue, you know, with you in your mind. You're watching them treat your sibling differently than they do you. So you woke up, you grow up with this binary issue of bipolar behavior. This person that I know that has it has that issue. So I thought it was very interesting.
I think that's more the mental body.
It said intuitive. It said mental unresolved childhood issues, but intuitive. One person in the childhood, in your childhood, you had a person in your childhood, like a sibling or something, that was treated differently. It makes sense to me.
Oh, I think. Are you talking about the family constellation therapy? Family systems therapy?
I don't remember. I just remember reading that five levels of healing model, and
yeah,
under intuitive it talked about that. And I just thought it was very interesting because that person has this problem. So I thought the connection was very interesting.
Well, one of the interesting things about that is that the family systems therapy, which looks at what happens in the whole constellation, talks about, this is where it gets into the energetic realm, which is what's stored in our energy field. And I don't talk about this a whole lot in the book, but I do some in a later chapter on the shamanic view of mental illness. It's partly in there. But the whole idea of all of our trauma is stored in the energy field, and so you need to do something to get that trauma out of the energy field. What techniques can you use for that? One of them is the resolution that happens with the family systems therapy. It's also called constellation therapy, which is looking at, it's sort of the energetic legacy of the family system, what comes down through the generations. It's less of a DNA issue and more of an energetic issue. And so we have not only the traumas from our own childhood, but we also have the traumas of our family system that goes back generations. And so all of that is stored in our energy field. And there are a lot of energy medicine and energy psychology techniques now that can help a person remove that trauma from the energy field. And this is interesting because often for certain cases, talk therapy will not touch this stuff. And it's only until, you know, the person could be in therapy for years, and this is one of those frustrations for therapists of, well, why isn't this client, moving out of this? But it may be that it's stuck in the energy field. And so techniques like EFT, which is emotional freedom techniques, it's also known as the tapping technique, which is tapping on these acupressure points, it somehow breaks the circuit of, that's a very simplistic way of describing it, but it somehow breaks the energetic loop that keeps this going round and round in the energy field and gets rid of it. And it can be very effective for things like anxiety, for example.
Well, we're just about out of time, so why don't you tell us again where we can find you? One thing I want to ask, what's the difference between your new book and this book?
Because this was in the early 2000s, it's just an updated version. So the statistics, for example, have changed, and I just want to give one that is, to me, just completely shocking. This is since I wrote the book, that from the mid-90s to 2010, the diagnosis among America's young increased of bipolar disorder increased 4,000%. And this is way beyond simply they're diagnosing it more because there's better diagnostic techniques. Obviously, at that number, 4,000%, this is way beyond the simply better diagnosis. I think there are it needs a lot of research to discover why this is happening. We can postulate, and I think the use of Ritalin among young people, or the rampant use of Ritalin, because that can sometimes trigger bipolar, it needs to be looked at as one example. So the way to reach me is www.stephaniemarone.com. It's StephanieMarohn.com. And I just wanted to say that the new edition of the book, the therapies are all the same. They stand the test of time. It's the statistics and some of the new information about the rising incidence among teens and children, for example, that are the updated part.
Thank you, Stephanie. It really is a great, informative book. It's probably one that I'll read several times.
Thank
you so
much.
Knowing that I have people in my life. So thank you for doing what you do.
Thank you, and I hope that your friend finds some healing.
I think so. I mean, my friend is open now. You know, now that he realizes there's something more than allopathic medicine, that he had gotten kind of hopeless with allopathic medicine.
Well, I'm glad to hear openness is a good thing.
Yeah. So have a good one, and thanks. And I know you'll be back again because you have many good books if you're willing to come.
Thank you so much.
Good night,
I appreciate you having me on the show.
It's my pleasure. Good night.